might give way to a shower. But she was, she knew, putting off what she wanted most to do, to climb the short peak of the rock, which now she set herself upon. There was no path, a fact that gave her great pleasure. No one, or almost no one, had ever been where she was, and so she climbed using tufts of grass and roots for handholds, and placed her feet upon the occasional rock outcroppings. She stopped once, having found a large hole, almost round, almost tidy, in the hillside. It had to be an animal's home, but what sort, she couldn't be sure. She imagined the burrows of rabbits and foxes, snakes and moles and mice, any of them equally possible and impossible here. And then she continued, up and up. It was not difficult. She was at the peak in minutes, joining a lone pine not much bigger than herself. She stood next to it, using its rough trunk for balance, and turned around. She saw the tiny white windows of the city far beyond. She watched the progress of a tanker, low slung and carrying a constellation of red lights into the Pacific. The beach suddenly seemed so far beneath her, and her stomach somersaulted. She looked east, now getting a better view of the seals' group of rocks, and saw a dozen or so of them lying about, sleeping. She looked up to the bridge above, not the Golden Gate, but a lesser one, its liquid white stream of cars still constant at midnight, and wondered if anyone could see her human silhouette against the silver bay. She remembered what Francis had once said, that he'd never known there was an island beneath the bridge at all. Most of the drivers and their passengers would not be looking down at her, would not have the faintest idea of her existence. Then, still holding the pine's bony trunk, she noticed, for the first time, a nest resting in the tree's upper boughs. She didn't dare touch it, knowing she would upset its equilibrium of sense and construction, but she badly wanted to see what was inside. She stood on a stone, trying to get above it, to look down into it, but she couldn't position herself high enough to get any perspective. Could she lift it, bring it down to her, to peek in, just for a second? She could, couldn't she, and then put it right back? No, she knew enough to know she couldn't. If she did, she'd ruin whatever was inside. She sat down, facing south, where she could see the lights, the bridges, the black, empty hills dividing the bay from the Pacific. All this had been underwater some millions of years ago, she'd been told. All these headlands and islands had been so far under, they would have barely registered as ridges on the ocean floor. Across the silver bay, she saw a pair of birds, egrets or herons, gliding low, heading north, and she sat for a time, her mind drifting toward blank. She thought of the foxes that might be underneath her, the crabs that might be hiding under the stones on the shore, the people in the cars that might be passing overhead, the men and women in the tugs and tankers, arriving to port or leaving, sighing, everyone having seen everything. She guessed at it all, what might live, moving purposefully or drifting aimlessly under the deep water around her. But she didn't think too much about any of it. It was enough to be aware of the million permutations possible around her, and take comfort in knowing she would not, and really could not, know much at all. When May arrived back at Marion's beach, it looked at first just as she'd left it. There were no people visible, and the light within Marion's trailer was as it was before, rose-colored and dim. May jumped to the shore, her feet shushing deep into the wet sand, and she dragged the kayak up the beach. Her legs were sore, and she stopped, dropped the kayak, and stretched. With her hands over her head, she looked toward the parking lot, seeing her car. But now there was another car next to it. And as she was regarding this second car, wondering if Marion was back, May was blinded by white light.
"Stay there!"
an amplified voice roared. She turned instinctively away. The amplified voice came again.
"Don't move!"
it said, now with venom. May froze there, off balance, worrying briefly about how long she could maintain such a pose. But there was no need. Two shadows descended upon her, grabbed roughly at her arms, and handcuffed her hands behind her. May sat in the back of the squad car, and the officers, calmer now, weighed whether or not what May was telling them, that she was a regular renter, had a membership, and was merely late in returning a rental, could be the truth. They had reached Marion on the phone, and she corroborated that May was a customer, but when they had asked if May had rented that day and was just tardy, Marion had hung up and said she'd be right over. 20 minutes later, Marion arrived. She was in the passenger seat of a vintage red pickup truck, the driver a bearded man who appeared bewildered and annoyed. May, seeing Marion walk unsteadily to the police car, realized she had been drinking, and possibly the bearded man had too. He was still in the car and seemed determined to stay there. As Marion made her way to the car, May caught her eye, and Marion, seeing May in the back of a squad car, her arms cuffed behind her, seemed to sober instantly.
"Oh, Jesus Christ," she said, rushing to May.
She turned to the officers.
"This is May Holland. She rents here all the time. She has the run of the place. How the hell did this happen? What's going on here?"
The officers explained that they'd gotten two separate messages about a probable theft.
"We got one call from a citizen who doesn't wish to be identified."
And then they turned to Marion.
"And the other warning came from one of your own cameras, Ms. Lefebvre."
May barely slept. Her adrenaline kept her pacing through the night. How could she be so stupid? She wasn't a thief. What if Marion hadn't saved her? She could have lost everything. Her parents would have been called to bail her out, and her position at the Circle would be lost. May had never gotten a speeding ticket and never been in trouble at any level, and now she was stealing a $1,000 kayak? But it was over, and Marion had even insisted, when they parted, that May come back.
"I know you'll be embarrassed, but I want you to come back here. I will hound you if you don't."
She knew May would be so sorry and full of shame that she wouldn't want to face Marion again. Still, when she woke after a few hours of fitful sleep, May felt a strange sense of liberation, as if she'd woken up from a nightmare to know it hadn't happened. The slate was blank, and she went to work. She logged on at 8:30. Her rank was 3,892. She worked through the morning, feeling the extraordinary focus possible for a few hours after a largely sleepless night. Periodically, memories from the night before came to her. The silent silver of the water, the lone pine on the island, the blinding light of the squad car, its plastic smell, the idiotic conversation with Mercer. But these memories were fading, or she was forcing them to fade, when she received a second screen message from Dan.
"Please come to my office ASAP. Jared will cover for you."
She rushed there, and when she got to his door, Dan was standing, ready. His face seemed to show some satisfaction that she'd hurried. Dan closed the door, and they sat down.
"May, do you know what I want to talk about?"
Was this a test to see if she would lie?
"I'm sorry, I don't," she tried.
Dan blinked slowly. "May, last chance."
"Is it about last night?"
she said. If he didn't know about the police, she could make something else up, something else that had happened after hours.
"It is." "May, this is very serious stuff."
He knew. God, he knew. In some recess of her mind, May realized that the Circle must have some web alert to notify them anytime a staff member was charged or questioned by the police. It only made sense.
"But there were no charges," she protested.
"Marion cleared everything up."
"Marion is the owner of the shop?"
"Yes."
"But May, you and I know there was a crime committed, don't we?"
May had no idea what to say.
"May, I'll spare you. Did you know that a member of the Circle, Gary Katz, had placed a sea change camera at that beach?"
Her stomach dropped into her shoe.
"No, I didn't." "And the owner's son, Walt, had set one up too?"
"No."
"Okay, first of all, that's troubling in and of itself. You go kayaking sometimes, yes? I see on your profile that you're a kayaker. Josiah and Denise say you had a good talk about this."
"I do go sometimes. It's been a few months."
"But you've never thought to check sea change to see about water conditions?"
"No, I should, but every time I go, it's really a spur-of-the-moment thing. The beach is on my way home from my parents' house, so..."
"And you were at your parents' house yesterday?"
Dan said, in a way that made clear that if she said yes, he would be even angrier.
"I was, just for dinner."
Dan stood now and turned from May. She could hear his breathing, a series of exasperated bursts. May had the distinct sensation she would be fired any moment. Then she remembered Annie. Could Annie save her? Not this time.
"Okay," Dan said.
"So you go home, missing any number of activities here,
And when you drive back this way, you stop by the rental shop after hours. Don't tell me you didn't know they were closed.
I figured they were, but I just stopped to make sure.
And when you saw a kayak outside the fence, you just decided to take it.
Borrow it. I'm a member there.
Have you seen the footage of this?
Dan asked.
He turned on his wall screen. May saw a clear, moonlight image of the beach from a wide-angle camera. The log line at the bottom of the screen indicated it had been taken at 10:14 p.m.
Don't you think a camera like this would be useful to you?
Dan asked. Water conditions at the very least? He didn't wait for a response.
Let's see you here.
He fast-forwarded a few seconds, and May saw her shadowy figure appear on the beach. Everything was very clear. Her surprise at finding the kayak, her moments of deliberation and doubt, then her quick work of bringing the vessel to the water and paddling out of view.
Okay, Dan said. As you can see, it's pretty obvious you knew you were doing something wrong. This is not the behavior of someone with a standing arrangement with Marge or whomever. I mean, I'm happy that you two colluded on your story and that you weren't arrested, because that would have made your working here impossible. Felons don't work at the Circle. But still, all of this makes me frankly sick to my stomach. Lies and diversions, it's just astounding to even have to deal with this.
Again, May had the distinct feeling, a vibration in the air that said she was being fired.
But if she was being fired, Dan wouldn't have spent this kind of time with her, would he? And would he fire someone Annie, who was far higher on the ladder, had hired?
If she were to hear about her termination from anyone, it would be Annie herself. So May sat, hoping this was going somewhere else.
Now, what's missing here?
He asked, pointing to the frozen image of May getting into the kayak.
I don't know.
You really don't know?
Permission to use the kayak?
Sure, he said curtly.
But what else?
May shook her head.
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Don't you usually wear a life preserver?
I do, but they were on the other side of the fence.
And if something happened to you out there, God forbid, how would your parents feel? How would Marge feel?
Marion,
how would she feel, May? Overnight, her business is over, finished. All the people who work for her, they're all out of work. The beach is shut down, kayaking in the bay, as a business overall, goes through the floor, all because of your carelessness. Forgive me for the bluntness, but because of your selfishness.
I know, May said, feeling the sting of truth. She had been selfish. She hadn't thought of anything but her own desire.
It's sad, because you've been improving so much. Your party rank was as high as 1668. Your conversion rate and retail raw were in the top quartile. And now this.
Dan sighed elaborately.
But as upsetting as this all is, it provides us with a teachable moment. And I mean a teachable moment on a life-changing level. This shameful episode has given you the chance to meet Eamon Bailey himself.
May's gasp was audible.
Yes, he took an interest in this, seeing how much it overlaps with his interests and the overall goals of the Circle. Would you be interested in speaking to Eamon about this?
Yes, May managed. Of course.
Good. He's anxious to meet you. At 6 this evening, you'll be brought to his office. Please collect your thoughts in the meantime.
May's head echoed with self-denunciations. She hated who she was. How could she have done that? Risked her job? Embarrassed her best friend? Jeopardized her father's health insurance? She was an imbecile, yes, but was she some sort of schizophrenic, too? What had overtaken her the night before? What sort of person does that?
Her mind argued with itself while she worked, feverishly, trying to do something visible to demonstrate her commitment to the company. She handled 140 customer queries, her record so far, while answering 1,129 survey questions and while keeping the newbies on target. The pod aggregate score was 98, which she took pride in, even while knowing there was some luck and some of Jared's involvement, too. He knew what was happening with May and had pledged his help. At 5 p.m., the shoot closed and May worked on her party rank for 45 minutes, bringing it from 1,827 to 1,430, a process entailing 344 comments, posts, and almost 1,000 smiles and frowns. She converted 38 major topics and 44 minor ones, and her retail raw was $24,050. She felt sure that this would be noticed and appreciated by Bailey, whose concentration on party rank was the most acute of the three wise men. At 5:45, a voice called her name. She looked up to see a figure at the door, someone new, a man of about 30. She met him at the door.
May Holland?
Yes?
I'm Dante Peterson. I work with Eamon, and he's asked me to bring you up to his office. You ready?
They took the same route May had taken with Annie, and along the way, May realized that Dante didn't know May had been to Bailey's office before. Annie had never sworn her to secrecy, but the fact that Dante didn't know indicated that Bailey didn't know, and that she shouldn't reveal this herself. As they entered the long crimson hallway, May was sweating heavily. She could feel rivulets making their way from her armpits to her waist. She couldn't feel her feet.
"Here's a funny portrait of the three wise men," Dante said as they stopped at the door. "Bailey's niece did it."
May pretended to be surprised by it, delighted by its innocence and crude insight. Dante took the large gargoyle knocker and rapped the door. It opened, and Bailey's smiling face filled the void.
"Hello," he said. "Hi, Dante. Hi, May."
He smiled wider, acknowledging his rhyme.
"Come in."
He was wearing khakis and a white button-down, looking freshly showered. May followed him as he took in the room, scratching the nape of his neck as if almost embarrassed by how well he'd done here.
"So, this is my favorite room. Very few people have seen it, not like I'm super secret about it or anything, but time just doesn't allow me to give tours and such. Have you seen anything like this before?"
May wanted to say, but couldn't, that she had seen this very room before.
"Not remotely," she said.
Something happened in Bailey's face at that moment, some twitch that seemed to bring the left corner of his eye and the left side of his mouth closer together.
"Thank you, Dante,"
Bailey said. Dante smiled and left, closing the heavy door behind him.
"So, May, tea?"
Bailey was standing before an antique tea set, a silver pot emitting a narrow corkscrew of steam.
"Sure," she said.
"Green? Black?"
he asked, smiling.
"Gray?"
"Green, thanks, but you don't have to."
Bailey was busy with the preparations.
"You've known our beloved Annie a long time,"
he asked, pouring carefully.
"I have, since sophomore year in college. 5 years now."
5 years? That's what, 30% of your life?
May knew he was rounding up a bit, but she emitted a tiny laugh.
"I guess so. A long time."
He handed her a saucer and cup and gestured for her to sit down. There were two chairs, both leather and overstuffed. Bailey dropped himself into his chair with a loud sigh and rested his ankle on his knee.
"Well, Annie is very important to us here, and thus you are too. She talks about you like you could end up being very valuable to this community. Do you believe that's true?"
"That I could be valuable here?"
He nodded, then blew on his tea. He looked over his teacup to her, his eyes steady. She met his gaze, then, briefly overwhelmed, she looked away, only to find his face again, this time in a framed photo on a nearby shelf. It was a formal portrait of Bailey's family in black and white, his three girls standing around their mother and Bailey, who were both sitting. Bailey's son was on his lap, wearing a tracksuit and holding an Iron Man action figure.
"Well, I hope so," May said. "I've been trying as hard as I can. I love the circle and can't express how much I appreciate the opportunity I've been given here."
Bailey smiled.
"Good, good. So tell me, how are you feeling about what happened last night?"
He asked the question as if genuinely curious, as if her answer might go in any number of directions. May was on firm ground now. No obfuscation was necessary.
"Terrible," she said. "I barely slept. I'm so ashamed I want to puke."
She wouldn't have used the word when talking to Stenton, but she felt Bailey might appreciate the coarseness. He smiled almost imperceptibly and moved on.
"May, let me ask you a question. Would you have behaved differently if you'd known about the sea change cameras at the marina?"
"Yes."
Bailey nodded emphatically.
"Okay,
How?
I wouldn't have done what I did.
And why not?
Because I would have been caught.